Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. You're listening to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and today on the show I'm speaking with journalist Robert Shear, whose columns appear in newspapers across the United States. He conducted the famous Playboy magazine interview in which Jimmy Carter confessed to the lust in his heart. He also interviewed Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and many other prominent political and cultural figures. From 1976 to 1993, he served as a national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, writing on diverse topics such as the Soviet Union, arms control, national politics, and the military. In 1993, he launched a nationally syndicated column based at the Los Angeles Times, which can now be accessed at his website, truthdig.com, where he is editor-in-chief. Robert Shear has written 8 books, including Thinking Tuna Fish, Talking Death, Essays on the Pornography of Power, With Enough Shovels, Reagan, Bush and Nuclear War, The 5 Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq, and Playing President, My Close Encounters with Nixon, Carter, Bush 1 and Clinton, and How They Did Not Prepare Me for George W. Bush. His recent book is The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Robert Shear, welcome to the show.
Yep, great to talk to you in Australia, I guess.
Yeah, Australia, in a fishing village. Robert, my introduction to you way back in the 80s was your book With Enough Shovels, Bush and Nuclear War, Reagan, Bush and Nuclear War. I was terribly impressed with that book and used it a lot in my speeches. Can you just summarise for the audience really what that book said and what was behind it?
Well, first of all, I think it's a good thing that you read the book and that you and the Physicians for Social Responsibility got involved and others, because we were, without really noticing it, starting to accept the idea of nuclear war fighting as legitimate. Our government was. And there were all these smart gun defense think tank guys saying, you know, you can win these things. These weapons are usable. They're good weapons. And so the unthinkable was becoming thinkable. And I sort of wandered into this as a journalist. I was interviewing all these people and asking them, you know, what are you going to do with these weapons? Why are you building more of them? Why are you trying to make them more sophisticated? And that's when I stumbled upon the development of these nuclear war fighting scenarios. And I think they were very serious about it and were moving quite rapidly in that direction. And I think the outcry from people like yourself and others, but of course you played a very prominent role, stopped them because the whole idea was so grotesque and inhuman that once it was brought out into the open, there was resistance. I don't think they've abandoned it totally, of course. That's why we still have all this stuff about missile defense and why we have all these tensions with Russia now, post-Soviet Russia, and trying to whip up the Chinese threat and so forth. But I think we basically, at least up to now, won that one.
Well, describe the plans that the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, had at that time. I think it was 1983, 82.
Just FEMA, though, because I first got involved with this interviewing Ronald Reagan.
And you interviewed Ronald Reagan?
Yes, I interviewed Reagan, and he had been hoodwinked by Edward Teller.
Yep.
And who always wanted to find a reason to use these weapons so that, you know, it would be legitimate in some way.
Yeah.
And Reagan really had started thinking in that direction, and the people around him. And in the Reagan administration, there were people in both, not just in the FEMA, but in the Defense Department and so forth, who were talking about how do we survive. And the whole idea was, the Soviets would engage in a first attack and we had to survive it and then retaliate. And this was nothing particularly new in that we always had the triad, and we always had the planes up there around the clock and all that sort of thing. But it took on an edge which suggested that this would not be the worst thing in the world. And if it's going to happen, let it happen, which then means you can take certain risks.
Mm.
It means you can downplay diplomacy. It can mean you can be less alarmed about the prospect of a war getting out of hand.
Mm.
And the basic ideological argument that was being advanced was that we have been traumatized by the possibility of using nuclear weapons, and this is incorrect, that these are, in fact, real weapons that can be used.
Mm.
And that was what was so dangerous. And in order to justify that, they came up with these ideas about civil defense and the survivability of your population and how you would use shelters. And the most absurd one, which was explained to me by an undersecretary of defense, T.K. Jones, which is what got a lot of attention when he spelled it out, is, you could dig a hole in the ground and put a few doors on top, pile some dirt on top of that, and you had a perfectly serviceable bomb shelter. And I remember some of the physicians in your group or in your allied group here actually did that.
Did they?
Yeah, they actually built those things and then, subjected them to various tests and talked about how absurd the whole thing was. And I just think, as long as these people are not challenged and as long as they're just doing this thinking at their, cloistered meetings, they can go off in very absurd directions. And what happened is this was one of those rare times when the public got involved in discussing defense issues. And I always thought the physicians played a particularly important role because, first of all, they had the arrogance of personality, being physicians.
Thank you.
Well, they do. I mean, they have this idea they can figure stuff out,
Yeah, we can.
Yeah, and so, because I know this because I toured around quite a bit talking to these different groups all around the country.
Yeah.
And some of these people were Republican. Some of them were quite conservative, these doctors. But they could do the science.
Mm.
And they empowered themselves. They said, wait a minute, I can figure out about nuclear war fighting. I don't have to leave it to the, to the specialists. And I certainly will have to figure out about how you survive because that's a medical issue.
Mm.
And as they say, I don't want to overflatter you, but I think you play probably the leading role in the whole world. I don't think it's any secret in calling attention to the human dimensions of it.
Mm.
What are we really talking about? What is survival and how would you survive it? And I think once the people started to do that, Mark Twain, I think, is the one who said a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth puts its pants on. But, this was a case where, people started to say, wait a minute, I can think about this and I can think about it intelligently. And then they said, wait a minute, these other people are being nonsensical. And I think that's what happened. And that's, of course, why the physicians won the Nobel Prize, because people recognized that. And it was physicians all over the world, as you well know. And I remember going to a conference. In fact, I think this had a lot to do with ending the Cold War, because I remember it was in Holland.
Mm.
It was an international physicians meeting, and the Soviets were there, and all sorts of people. In fact, our cardinal, well, he wasn't then the cardinal from Los Angeles, was there. There was a broad representation of people, and there was a recognition that the Cold War had reached really an extremely dangerous point.
Mm.
And it had to be stopped. And I think that even got through to Reagan at some point.
Yes,
at
it
Reykjavik,
did. Yeah.
Where when he met Gorbachev, and really what happened there was not, we'll build more weapons, was rather, hey, we got to call this off. And, that was an interesting moment at Reykjavik when both Gorbachev and Reagan said, let's not have any of these weapons. Let's go to zero.
Mm.
And I don't know if you remember, but Richard Perle and these neoconservatives were all shocked.
I do remember.
As such a possibility. But I think even Reagan at the end understood the basic inhumanity of this and was turned around on it. And that's why he was able to deal with Gorbachev at that time.
Yeah. I spent an hour and a quarter with Reagan actually in the White House holding his hand, kind of in a doctor-patient relationship. I'd just written my book, Missile Envy, so I had lots of facts. And the truth was that almost everything he said was factually, scientifically, technologically inaccurate. And I kept correcting him. And you know, when he got flustered and anxious, he'd get what we call a malar flush, but his cheeks would flush bright red. And then I'd have to hold his hand and pat it and reassure him to calm him down. And then he'd make another false allegation. And
that's probably what Nancy had been doing for him all his, much of his life.
I think so. And when I left, I thought, my God, I mean, I was so shocked. And I think I said later to people, I think he's got early Alzheimer's, which in fact was accurate. But it was, I think, one of the most scariest moments of my life. I thought it had no influence, but as you point out, and I think partly because of Gorbachev too, he came to realize, well, he started to say nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won. And I think inside he had a nice, kind heart, and he kind of understood it.
Yeah, and I also think his wife and some of the other people around him were shocked by the cold-hearted advisors that he had. I mean, I think, you know, the ordinary person has some sense of the fragility of life and respect for it. And what would happen with the Herman Kahns and all of those mega-death people, you know, you've seen the movie The Fog of War on McNamara.
I have, yes.
And I think it's really brilliant in tracing back that planning of the bombing of the Japanese cities and, and calculation of the death-to-bomb ratio and not caring whether they're civilians or military and breaking the spirit. And that kind of abstraction came to dominate the whole nuclear war field. And I used to go to these conferences and just be, that's where I got the title of my book, you know.
With Enough Shovels.
Well, no, but then I had another one, Thinking Tuna Fish Talking Death.
Yeah.
And it was because I'd go to these conferences and they would be talking about tens of millions of people dying. Yeah. But their real concern was, did they get invited to the good lunch where they had filet mignon, or did they have to eat the tuna fish sandwiches on the buffet table? And so in terms of, you know, there was a disconnect between what they were dealing with professionally, which was immense suffering for the human race, and their own preoccupation with career and their creature comforts. It was bizarre. And I would attend these conferences as a journalist and say, my goodness, are these poor people, they've gone crazy here, you know? And so anyway, I think this was a case where the public caught up with what was going on. Mm. And it was one of those rare cases where actually democracy works.
Yeah. Yeah, I called it the Second American Revolution because when I first started talking about nuclear war in 78, almost everyone I spoke to in America said, well, it's better to be dead than red. And I'd say, what about the pygmies in Africa? They'll be dead too. And they said, yeah, they don't want to be communists either. And in 5 years, and I think led by the physicians, 80% of Americans became acutely opposed to the nuclear arms race.
Well, they weren't able to marginalize you. You know, they would have liked to do what they've been able to do to say to somebody like Cindy Sheehan.
Yeah.
And kind of reduce you to a crazy person or an obsessed person. And I think, you know, somehow you well, first of all, it helped a lot being this really smart doctor. But you retained your humor and your balance, and they couldn't get you. Mm. And, I mean, really, I remember how it came down. They would have loved to have you be this batty, obsessed lady.
Mm.
And you just didn't go along. You know, you really stuck to your logical points, and yet you possessed that humanity. And I think it was really a very good, I mean, not a good, maybe one of the best examples ever of citizen activism, you know, and not just on your part, but on all of
everybody.
These people. Yeah. I mean, it was really startling to me because, as I said, I don't mean to be dismissive of doctors, but you know well that they can be a really arrogant bunch.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they also can be very, you know, out for their own money and their own careers and very conservative. And something snapped. And I just remember, you know, I forget all their names now, but, you know, who was the Harvard heart guy?
Lown.
Yeah, and the guy from City College in New York.
Yeah,
and there's a whole bunch of them. And Hyatt, I think, is another guy. He was the public health.
Howard Hyatt from
the and these people,
health.
I mean, I just thought, where did these people come from? Mm. You know, suddenly they were using all of their smarts and their aggressiveness and their everything for the public good.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I thought...
Well, that's what we kind of do in medicine, you know, even though we might be arrogant. We always have the patient's interest at heart, fundamentally and basically. To get back to Reykjavik, I actually went to Reykjavik in Iceland some years after that conference. I think it was in 88, wasn't it? And or 87. And the Icelanders told me two very funny stories. One was that they cleared the area around that little house where Reagan and Gorbachev met for hundreds of meters. And they had soldiers on the periphery guarding it. Reagan and Gorbachev were meeting in the downstairs sitting room, but in the basement were the KGB, and they got a bit plastered on vodka, and one of them threw a lit match into the waste paper basket because he'd lit his cigarette, and it burnt, and they nearly burnt the whole house down. That was number one. And number two, Gorbachev, of course, came...
You know, by the way, you have there probably the key ingredient for the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Was the vodka drinking.
Oh, I know. And the soldiers used to drink the antifreeze liquid out of their tanks when they ran out of vodka. Anyway, the other apocryphal story really was that Gorbachev turned up with all these facts and figures and plans to abolish nuclear weapons, and Reagan was going along with it. Meanwhile, the Prince of Darkness, Richard Pearl, was up in the bathroom, sitting on the lavatory, because it was such a small house, writing out numbers on pieces of toilet paper furiously to counter what the Soviets had brought in their proposal. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, well, Pearl was the one that felt most betrayed by this personally. And that came back to haunt us after, because, of course, he was the leader of the neoconservatives who got us into the Iraq War and everything else, which is what my pornography of power book is all about. And so what is disturbing for me is that one would have thought we had won these battles for common sense, and you could go on to some other issues. But what happened for the 8 years under Bush was that these very same people came back, and they came back with a vengeance, and they got us into this horrible mess.
So they
wanted another Cold War, and this anti-terrorism thing was going to be the new Cold War. And they actually jacked up military spending to a higher point in real dollars, and inflation-adjusted dollars than at any point during the Cold War, whether the Korean War or the Vietnam War, and we're now saddled with this incredible spending, and even Barack Obama is now planning to increase military spending, and the military-industrial complex, which everyone has ignored, is stronger than ever, and they account for more than half of discretionary spending of the U.S. Congress, and no one talks about it. It's really kind of depressing, and that's what, as I say, the Pornography of Power book was all about.
All right, so what do you think is the pathology behind Richard Pearl, Robert Scheer?
You know, I can't really answer that question, and my book doesn't, because what happens to people is all sorts of things get mixed up, and they themselves don't know what's going on.
Mm.
So Pearl, first of all, has lined his pockets. I discussed that in the book. He took a lot of money, $20 million, from Boeing and so forth for his venture capital firm. He became a very wealthy person through his military support of the military. And at the same time, he seems to have a serious, fanatical, ideological bent, which is consistent with lining his own pocket. And does he know at any time of the day whether he's operating out of self-interest or out of some sort of ideological obsession? I don't know. But they managed to merge the two in a way, a seamless whole, so that you're comfortable. You're saving the world, and yet you're lining your pocket.
Saving America, you mean?
Well, they claim they're saving the world.
Oh, well, no, but they also say America must dominate.
Yeah, but America is dominated because it's the center of freedom. It alone. You know, he's turned out, I think, to be absolutely the most brilliant observer of all this was Graham Greene, the novelist.
Oh, really?
And I think so, because Graham understood what has been called imperial hubris.
Yeah.
And whether he talked about in The Quiet American about Vietnam, whether he talked about the power and the glory of in Mexico, whether he talked about our man in Havana in Cuba, he understood the mind of the imperial mentality. He understood that arrogance. And you know, yes, we will go in there. We're not there just to line our pockets. We're and get your resources. We're going to save you. And that wonderful but treacherous marriage of the these impulses, you know, he grabbed it. And if you know, just read The Quiet American again, or read any of his books, really, he understood it. And that's what they want to deny. They want to be, you know, the unsullied agents of change and virtue. And of course, they're not. They evidently don't. There's no sense of regret. To this day, you don't get any sense that they betrayed us, that they wasted people's lives, killed people unnecessarily. Even McNamara in that fog of war had a certain amount of guilt.
He's got regret, I know, Bob.
Yeah, a certain amount of remorse, a certain amount of questioning. You don't get that from the neoconservatives. Not one instant of that.
Well, I've noticed that people on their deathbed, who was it? Was it Atwood who was Reagan's sort of front man? There was Phillips, and I think it was the guy who died of a brain tumor who sort of led the attack for Reagan. And on his deathbed, he recanted. And
yeah, but he was not one of the Cold War thinkers. He was an operative.
He was an operative.
Lee Atwater.
Yeah, Lee Atwater.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm not saying. I mean, there are plenty of them. Mike Deaver, and Reagan himself, I think, had doubts.
He did.
I'm talking about this narrow band of neoconservatives, and they're really not conservative.
They're not conservative
about
at all.
No,
they're radical.
And they're a small group, and they're generally come out of their parents were generally disaffected people from the left, and so forth. They're very much given to that old idea, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. I guess it was Lenin's idea or Trotsky's, I'm not sure. And they believe, you know, in confusion and creating new realities, and somehow they're always at the center of it, and they're the wise people. And it's incredibly dangerous. And I think they've been discredited for now, but they'll come back again, or people like them will come back.
Well,
again.
I think what we have to do is what we did, Bob Scheer, in the early part of the 80s, is expose these people, expose the philosophies. And, you know, at this time of global financial crisis, when everything's crumbling beneath our feet, I mean, England now is in a state like Iceland is, that we have to expose the Pentagon spending. I mean, they are spending, if you add up all the black budgets and the budgets for Afghanistan and Iraq, and nearly $1 trillion a year.
Yeah, well, the proper way to think about it is, if you take out the entitlement programs like Social Security and so forth, which no one is going to touch.
No, Medicare, Social Security.
We would have a revolution in this country if you tried to, because they're very successful programs.
Yeah, yeah.
We took a group that was basically reduced to poverty, older people,
yep,
and we saved them, yep, with Medicare and Social Security. And people understand that, not just older people, but their grandchildren, who don't have to carry that financial burden, understand it. So those programs are not only not going to be cut, they're going to be expanded.
Yep.
And so if you look at the budget that Congress gets to play with, that's what we call the discretionary budget.
After those programs are out.
And upwards of 60% of that budget goes to the military, okay? So there, when you talk about all these things that Barack Obama wants to do, whether it's education, improving the cities, even having more policemen, you're not going to find that money if you don't cut the military. That's the hard nut here. That was true before the meltdown, okay?
Yep.
It's particularly true.
Particularly true now.
Now after. I think in many ways, and the two are connected, I think, in terms of how this meltdown occurred, because after all, the prevailing ideology of the Bush administration was one of total deregulation.
Yeah.
And
which
the signs
led to this horrible economic collapse.
Well, the signs of this breakdown were very early. We had Enron, we had WorldCom. I mean, this didn't happen all yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, and so the amazing thing is that they were able to use this war on terror. Yes, there were legitimate things you could do, police actions and better intelligence and cooperate with other people around the world and so forth. But instead of doing that, they launched a new Cold War, which had nothing to do with fighting terrorism. And I just, you know, to toot my own horn here.
Yeah, toot your own horn.
Okay, let me just tell you, in 2002, this is before I got pushed out of the L.A. Times.
Yeah, why did they push you out, incidentally?
Well, because the Chicago Tribune bought the paper, and I don't know, it's not that interesting. But, you know, there isn't that much room for dissent. If you go to truthdig.com now, you'll see that we run Chris Hedges, who I think is the best journalist in America at this moment. And he was with the New York Times for 8 years, was their bureau chief.
And he left, didn't he?
At least, well, they pushed him out. They pushed him out because he dared say something at
against the Iraq War.
Yeah, at a commencement address. And, you know, and he's now on truthdig.com, you know, because there isn't a lot of room in the mass media. But I wrote this article in 2002.
Right.
Okay, so that's quite a long time ago. And it began, people can get it on our website or The Nation or Alternate, but anyway, it began, has the war on terrorism become the modern equivalent of the Roman circus, drawing the people's attention away from the failures of those who rule them? Corporate America is a shambles because deregulation, the mantra of our president and his party, has proven to be a license to steal. Yet to question our leaders' stewardship of the economy is made to seem unpatriotic. And then I just go on. Although combating terrorism is of compelling importance and should have been before September 11th, one is likely to be granted a nut for daring to suggest that the administration might be using current security threats as a smokescreen to obscure our floundering economy. I wrote that in 2002. And it was very clear, you know, if you looked at what was happening then, the Enron, which Bush was up to in his eyeballs, you know.
Kenny baby.
Yeah. Global Crossing, Tyco, Dynergy, Rite Aid, they were all having these problems. All had to do with deregulation, with letting them do their thing. So, and I think the war on terror was, you know, his way of glossing over all those problems, which were quite real then. And so we wasted resources, got a lot of people killed, and diverted the attention from thinking about what really was happening. You know, why are we making the wrong cars? Why are our banks messing up? You know, what do multinational corporations do? How can you control all those questions that people are asking now when it's very late?
Yeah.
You know, so I do think that getting back to your earlier point about the neoconservatives and so forth, I think the main thing is, and in my pornography power book, I raise this question, you can't really have a democratically controlled republic, which is what our founders wanted and what they wrote into the Constitution, and have an imperial power. The two are inherently in conflict.
Why? Explain that, Robert Scheer.
Yeah, because if you're going to be, and this Washington and Jefferson and understood very well. If you're going to be involved in what they call foreign entanglements, foreign engagements, and so forth, you are going to, truth will be the first casualty. The basic information the public has, remember, they had in mind for our system an informed public. Without an informed public, you don't have any kind of...
An informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. Jefferson.
Yeah, but to be informed, you have to have access to information.
Yep.
And what happens when you get into these imperial ventures,
yep.
you no longer... can do due diligence. You no longer can get the information. You can't demand it. Your representatives are cowed by national security.
Why?
So,
why cowed?
Because they say, hey, the enemy is at the gate. To dissent now, to question now, will be weakening us. And so, you know, as they say, truth is the first casualty.
Yeah.
Patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels. Washington, in his farewell address, I quote him in my book, something no one ever seems to quote Washington's farewell address on this, but he said, you know, we have to beware of the impostures of pretended patriotism. The impostures of pretended patriotism. And what they were very aware of is what was the lesson of Europe for them. That whatever, or the Roman Empire, whatever your intentions as far as people controlling their destiny, they would be sacrificed to the needs of empire, which put an emphasis on militarism, on secrecy, on lying, on jingoism. And that's what's happened. Once we had this attack of 9/11, we forgot about torture, due process, you know, all these things. The privacy of your mail, of your correspondence, the rights of the citizen, all of that lying became the norm. And that's what it's all about. And so when I say, no, don't expand the war in Afghanistan, no, don't manage the whole world, no, don't think you have to be the indispensable ingredient to straightening out everybody's life in the world militarily. Do it with aid if you want. Do it with Doctors Without Borders or whatever, but don't do it militarily, because when you do it that way, whatever your original intentions, you will destroy your own system.
But America's always had an empire, the manifest destiny, what it did.
We've always had a tension between
South America.
We didn't always. I don't think George Washington had.
Oh, okay. Right at the beginning, you didn't.
And the whole idea of the founders was to avoid that.
But you got into it pretty early, didn't you?
No, we've always had a tension. We've always had a tension. We've always had people who warned against it, and we've always had people who advanced imperialism and interest on both sides.
Mm.
That's what the struggle is all about. That's what happened during the Iraq War. At the end of the day, those of us who were against empire won, but very late, too late for lots of people who died and lots of resources wasted.
But there's still an empire. I mean, America's got how many bases, over 1,000 military bases in many countries in the world? I mean,
right.
And especially in Australia, there are 34 U.S. bases with Pine Gap, which is the biggest CIA base in the world in the middle of our country, which orchestrates a killing in Iraq with smart weapons and in Afghanistan. And so we're an integral part of the American empire.
Right.
And I think it's done surreptitiously, and people don't quite know what's going on in many countries.
Well, the difficulty is, again, it's once you embrace that image of the enemy as primarily a military threat, indeed a conventional military threat, and you're in a global war, that's how they pictured the war on terror, then you stop thinking in a rational way. You stop demanding information, you stop demanding logic, and you surrender to the passions that are calculated by powers that be, and propaganda. And it's very difficult to fight against that. And even with all the lying of the Bush administration, it took us years to unmask that.
Yeah. I'm interviewing Robert Scheer, a very famous reporter from California, who's written some absolutely fabulous books, including his latest, The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Bob, but hasn't that always been the dynamic of the human race? And it maybe goes back to tribalism. You know, we're here to protect our tribe. That tribe out there, you know, outside the cave, they're dangerous, and you can accrue to them whatever nasty motives that you want to, as an excuse to decimate them. I mean, doesn't it go way, way, way back in our psyche?
Of course it does. But what our founders, and regrettably they all were white males primarily.
Yeah.
I don't deny that. But they had a wisdom that was really quite, you know, quite astounding. They understood that part of human nature. And that's what they wanted to counter. That's why we had limited government. That's why we had due process. That's why we had, you know, all of these guarantees, not only in the Bill of Rights, but in the very fabric of the Constitution. That's why it had to be written down. That's why they didn't want a strong federal government.
Mm.
You know, I don't know. You've got to, if people do nothing else, if they don't buy my book, go on the Internet, read George Washington's farewell address. You know, he thought he was only going to serve one term. He wrote it before the end of his first term. He shared it with a number of his colleagues, Madison and others, and then he pulled it out of the desk and distributed it, you know, and it's a marvelous document because he shuns, here's a general, and he certainly understood that we had enemies, you know, he understood the English could return and did, he understood that there were others out there, but the whole thing is a cautioning against the passions of militarism, and he uses words like, use gentle means. Don't try to influence by force. Let the natural flow of events. Don't impose your will on the world. Avoid foreign machinations. I mean, they were so conscious of this. Because after all, they had started out admiring England and France.
Yes.
And then they were, you know, appalled by what happened. And you know, they had time to read and think.
Yeah.
And they came up with an incredible truth. And what scares me about the military-industrial complex, which is stronger than ever in the United States, stronger than ever, and now it's being seen as a jobs program, so there's a lot of support among Democrats as well as Republicans for throwing money at the military, even for things like the Virginia-class sub or the F-22, which no one could defend. No one thinks has any value. But now they say, well, there are jobs connected with it. And if you think of it in those terms, it's not as ominous as the correct way of thinking about it, which is they won't be happy with just the jobs. People who make these weapons want to find reasons to use them.
Of course.
And that's when they do the threat inflation. That's when they sell incredibly simplistic views of the enemy. That's when they, you know, have it be black and white of how we are in the world. That's the real danger of the military-industrial complex, is they gain control of our thoughts. You know, they have a great propaganda machine.
Yep. Yep.
You know, so when you go watch a football game, you know, like the Rose Bowl, they got the stealth fighter flying above.
Or
they got the B-2 bomber flying above.
Really?
You know, and these planes have nothing to do with any military function. They were designed to penetrate Soviet air defenses.
With hydrogen bombs.
Yeah, but that were never built. You know, Soviet air defenses, with the F-22, do fighter pilot fighting with Soviet aircraft that never were built. And so there really is no military function for them, but they are like these totems that we worship.
Yeah.
And the military-industrial complex thrusts them out to impress you and, you know, they're awe-inspiring with their technology. And then, but if that was fine, if they were just totems to dance around, they wouldn't be so threatening. But they aren't. That people will find reasons to use them. They will find, you remember Rumsfeld said that we had to go to Iraq because there were no good targets in Afghanistan.
I did remember that, yeah.
Yeah,
and
what he was
book.
Saying was, at least with Iraq, they could build up the Hitler image. They could say, well, he's got an army. He's got, you know, he didn't have anything.
No.
He's a toothless, you know,
and he was a CIA appointee.
Originally.
Yep.
Originally he was recruited because he participated in the...
He was used to fight Iran after the Ayatollah.
Oh, no, but his rise in power started with when he was part of a team that was supposed to assassinate Qasem. And Qasem was considered bad because he was tilting towards the Soviets. And so that's where
who?
He got his start. Huh?
Assassinate... Oh, that's right. That was another Iraqi.
Yeah, that was the leader.
Yeah.
And Saddam Hussein was just some young guy, and he was part of this group that was going to... and they didn't succeed. He was only wounded.
That's right.
And that's when he started his whole relation.
Yeah.
Of course, and yes, and then during the Iran-Iraq war, he was our agent. But that was the thing. With Iraq, they could develop this idea, look, there's Hitler, there's a big army, there's a big threatening force. And they couldn't do that with Afghanistan because these people had no army, you know, and... So that was the reason why Iraq, aside from that, also had the oil resources, which they wanted to control and would pay for all this, became a better target. But what I'm saying is these people will do the threat inflation. They will find the reasons for war. They will shape our perspective in that direction, and they will deny the value of diplomacy, of trade, of human contact, because those don't involve the weapons that they profit from.
Meanwhile, the threat of nuclear war still hangs over the planet as it did throughout the Cold War, with thousands of weapons in Russia and America on hair trigger alert. And that's the elephant in the sitting room, which since the Cold War ended, I think almost everyone has ignored.
Well, I'm a little bit more optimistic on this one now. First of all, in this whole crazy going to Iraq and everything, we ignored the main proliferation of nuclear weapons, which came from Pakistan, which we had befriended, and A.Q. Khan, you know, is now a free man in Pakistan. So this bellicose policy of the Bush administration failed to address the real source of nuclear proliferation, which was not Saddam Hussein. It was our ally and
A.Q. Khan was or is a physicist who actually developed a nuclear Walmart around the world and was distributing the know-how to make nuclear weapons around the world.
To Libya and Iran and to North Korea.
Yes.
And he's now a free man. He's been released. He's just.
He's a national hero in Pakistan.
Yeah, he was never more than
like Edward Teller was in America.
Right. Yeah. Well, he's considered the father of the Islamic bomb, and Teller was the father of the H bomb. But the one reason I'm optimistic, and I know some of your listeners on Pacifica Radio will probably take my head off for this. But I think Hillary Clinton is starting to show signs of getting it. And I thought her meeting,
in Russia
was very, very good. I think she's reaching out even to Iran. She's understands you have to deal with the Palestinian issue and that there has to be development of a two-state solution. So I think, I'm hoping that she's going to try to make her mark as a peacemaker. And so far, so good as far as I can see.
Well, isn't she acting under the instruction, surely, of the president? That's my feeling.
Well, yes, but, you know, she's a force unto herself. And I must say, you know, Bill Clinton's one real achievement in foreign policy was he advanced the Arab-Israeli peace process, the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. He did advance that, and then Bush gave it the back of his hand. And I'm hoping that Hillary Clinton is intending to really use her credibility with the American Jewish community, pro-Israel community, because most American Jews are quite rational on this subject, and to talk about why peace is in everyone's interest. And I'm just hoping, I hope I'm not disappointed, but I see some signs that she, and with Barack Obama's support, might actually be able to make some progress, particularly in the area that you're talking about, the neglected area of nuclear weapons.
And
I thought it was very good. She said, look, let's have this restart. Let's, you know, begin again and not visit these disputes of the last 8 years. And I think that's very good, very
healthy.
Well,
I agree with you, Bob Scheer, but I think that she's under specific instructions from Obama. I think that's his philosophy and the way he wants to go, which brings us to the next question. What is he going to do about this Pentagon budget? I know that Barney Frank, who is the head of the House Armed Services Committee now, wants to reduce the Pentagon budget by 25%, which isn't nearly enough. Where do you think Obama's heart and mind lies in this area of during this period of intense economic...
Well, I think Barney Frank is in banking now, and that's really going to be his main preoccupation.
I think
the thing with Obama is that he has bought into the idea that we have to expand the military
budget. Do you really think so?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, they've said they're going to go up, I think, between 4 and 6% over Bush's budget. The question is what he's going to try to do, I think, because Gates is no dummy, Secretary of Defense. And he has understood, and Barack Obama did say in his speech, we have to stop building these Cold War era.
Yeah.
Weapons. Well, those Cold War era weapons are exactly the ones the military-industrial complex wants. They're high tech. They're expensive.
Name them.
The F-35, the fighter jet, the F-22, the Virginia class submarine, the C-17 cargo plane. I go through a whole long list of these. But it's very clear that these are weapons that Boeing and Lockheed want. They're all laid out. I have chapters on some of them in my Pornography of Power book. And there's no military justification for it. So I think what Gates and Obama are going to try to do is say, okay, we need to be able to fight asymmetrical war. We need to have better armor for our troops. We have to, you know, and some of that is true. But I don't think this military-industrial complex is going to roll over. They have massive advertising campaigns, massive lobbying campaigns, and they're now selling themselves the jobs program. And they get strong support from some of the unions. You know, you try to kill the C-17 cargo plane, which no one wants, and you got Democrats and Republicans.
Which has been made in California, right? And Barbara Boxer supports.
It's made in Long Beach, and it's a jobs program, and you got everybody jumping to the most right-wing congressman or that Virginia class submarine. I mean, it's you know what, 7,000 jobs in Groton, Connecticut, and these things cost $3 billion apiece.
Led by Lieberman and Dodd.
Yeah, and it's incredible. Somebody once pointed out, you know, it was about the stealth bomber, but it also applies to the F-22 stealth fighter plane. And said, you know, I was having an argument. It was actually at UCLA with a guy who knew a lot about these defense weapons. And he said, Bob, your book has got it all wrong. The B-2 stealth bomber is a brilliant weapon. It's a wonderful weapon. And I said, wait a minute, what does it do? It's supposed to penetrated the Soviet air defense that doesn't exist and bomb what's left over after all the missiles have destroyed everything. And he said, no, you're missing the whole point. He said, it's a wonderful weapon because there's a part for this plane that's built in every single congressional district.
Oh, I know.
And that's true of the F-22.
That's how they control the Congress. They put their factories in every single...
Right, and so now with the whole economic meltdown, the what I'm worried about is the weapons systems are being pushed as a jobs program. They're not a good jobs program. They're very ineffective. The multiplier effect is very low. You have to bend a lot of metal. You have to waste a lot of resources per job. It'd be much better to put more police on the street or have more school teachers. I mean, there's lots of things you
can
do.
But I thought Obama wanted to upgrade the infrastructure of the United States, roads, bridges, trains.
And those things create many more jobs.
Many more jobs.
Well, this is where we're going to have the real struggle here, because you simply will not find the money without cutting the military.
Yeah, exactly.
You won't. It doesn't exist. I mean, we're stretched very thin now. And there is going to be a push to challenge it. Now you got people like Murtha and others who are very influential, Congressman Murtha, who are pushing for this. As I point out in my book, somebody who's very liberal, Barbara Boxer, the senator from California, but she supports any weapon that's built in California.
And does Murtha too?
Oh, Murtha supports Virginia. Anything that will help you get some more. Well, first of all, Murtha's had more congressional pork for military come to his district than anyone. But this is the real problem now. There was a very good article in the Washington Post just 2 days ago by Jeffrey Smith and someone else, I forget the name, but laying out all of the military programs that pushed people. The Virginia-class sub, before Obama was even inaugurated, the Democrats pushed through a bill with Republican support to throw $14 billion at more subs.
Now,
do you need subs to go get a guy in a landlocked cave?
Is that a fast attack submarine, the Virginia submarine?
Yeah, the Virginia, but there's no need for it.
Does it
there's
carry
no
nuclear
to,
weapons, cruise well, missiles?
Anything can have nuclear weapons, but that's not supposed to be its main function. Its main function is to do battle with Chinese subs.
Oh, and the Chinese don't have any subs.
No, so the whole crazy thing is we're borrowing money from the, really, we're going into hock borrowing money from the Chinese to build subs, to count the subs that the Chinese have no intention of building.
This is psychotic.
Well, it's not psychotic.
It is psychotic. There's a split between reality and the perception of reality. The Chinese have no subs.
Yeah, but that doesn't bother Lieberman. He knows
no,
that.
No, I know, but it's psychotic thinking.
No, because it is. It's self-centered.
No, it's psychotic. There's a split between reality. The Chinese have no subs.
Okay, but
and the perception of reality, well, they might get some, or, maybe they do have some.
No, but he doesn't believe that for a second. He's just lying to us.
He's lying to us.
Yeah, he knows he's lying. Come on, they know they're lying. They read the same intelligence reports that I finally get to see. They know that it's utter nonsense. They know that the Russian subs leak so badly they can't leave port. They know all that stuff. But this is an argument they throw out there to whip up public
support.
So
they're stealing American taxpayers' money, which should go into their health care and their education and the whole thing, to build weapons to kill people.
Yes.
I mean, it's all a killing machine. The Pentagon is nothing about defense. It's all about offense. It should be called what it once was, the Department of War. The Department of War. It's nothing to do with defense.
See, now, if you push somebody like Lieberman, he would probably say, he would probably have to admit that these weapons aren't very useful.
Yeah.
But he would. What they're really saying is, we don't think you're going to appropriate the money to create jobs in Connecticut, so we're not going to give up this program. That would be one way of thinking about it. That's very sad. If as a country we can't, use public funds to create jobs that we really need, for instance, right now we could have a program. I've been advocating it. Nobody seems to pay attention. But I say, why don't we buy these subprime mortgages that are causing all the trouble and make them available to school teachers? We want school teachers to live in the districts where they teach. We've always accepted that as a very – we want policemen to live in the districts where they work, firemen. Why don't we give them, government-guaranteed loans to buy these houses? Some of them are very nice, and condos and – in their area, a community like Oakland, California, has a total glut on brand new condominiums. Why don't you say to school teachers, I happen to have a son who's a school teacher up there, why don't you say to school teachers and firemen and cops and anyone else working for the city, we will have a city-backed, state-backed program, which the feds will put money into, that will allow you to buy these abandoned homes or homes that were never bought. That's the best thing you can do about the economic meltdown. But that would be seen wildly wasteful and socialistic, and yet you say, let's throw money at Boeing in the hopes that some of the programs create some jobs, and everybody thinks that's hard-headed.
Well, the Pentagon is a totally socialistic operation. Totally.
Yes. In the the worst sense.
In the very, very worst sense. I mean, I don't know if the world has any future if America continues its addiction to weapons and killing. I don't know if it does, particularly as the nuclear weapons are still sitting there ready to go. And that combined with global warming, and the money should be spent on developing renewable energy right across America, solar power, wind power, geothermal power, efficiency, the whole thing. I mean, and that would employ millions more people than the Pentagon ever would hope to employ. So we've got the threat of nuclear war always there every second of every day, exacerbated by this huge weapons buildup. We've got global warming upon us right now. We've got the global economic collapse.
Well, if you really want to get frightened, think about it. If you really do have economic collapse.
Right, we do.
Well, we don't have rioting in the streets.
You don't have bread lines yet.
We don't have people running around wheelbarrows filled with marks and so forth.
Although England is printing money at this point
well,
in time.
Well, I understand very well. What happens when you have... I'm old enough, you know, I was only a little kid during the Depression, but I grew up with that fear.
Yeah.
My father lost his job when I was born, and he didn't get it until the war started, and I understand the mentality.
Yeah.
And if you have panic, you look for scapegoats.
Yeah.
And the best, I mean, that's when demagogues
that's
arise.
That's what Hitler did.
Yeah, that's when demagogues arise, and they point the finger at who's responsible, find a scapegoat, and you go to war.
Mm.
And what I'm really worried about is if we can't get the system functioning, and we're going to look for scapegoats. We're going to look for enemies, and we're going to find that great distraction of war, and people are going to go for it because war is going to promise
really
pride and jobs and everything else, and that's very worrisome, because that's what economic chaos is breeds, and we're very close to it now. You know, I'm hoping we get it turned around. I'm hoping Barack Obama works out the right combination. I think there's a lot of strength left in our societies, but I am very concerned.
Well,
because,
not just the United States, though, Bob Scheer. It's Europe as well, particularly the Eastern Bloc. But there's concern in Germany. They're rioting in Spain and the like. You know, this. You're right. This is when fascistic or ultra-extreme groups arise, particularly of young men who are without jobs, who are frustrated, who are angry.
Right.
And so it's not just the United States.
And that's when you get a marriage between big business and the mob.
Yeah.
Which is what fascism was, you know, after all. I mean, those big companies there, you know, some of which are still around
Volkswagen.
In Germany. Yeah. You know, there were Mercedes as well, wasn't there? BMW. No, but I mean, they went along quite easily with all that because it ensured their prosperity in the short run.
Mm.
And this is really what is quite frightening, because we're used to a very high standard of living in the United States, and if there's any dislocation in that, people are going to go wild.
Well, I think one redeeming feature is that the American people, thank God, elected Barack Obama, who seems to have his feet firmly planted on the ground, who's highly intelligent, and I think is a different kind of character and the sort of character America and the world indeed needs now.
Yeah, I agree with that. And on the other hand, I have my concerns.
Yes, and I just hope that the crises aren't severe enough so that he gets out of his depth. That's what I'm a little...
Well, no, I think that the real problem is the wisdom is not in Barack Obama. It's in the people who saw through Bush and pushed him. And I think people have now got to pressure a Barack Obama to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's not the subject of this interview, but I think, frankly, throwing trillions of dollars at the big banks is not the right thing to do. And they're not rewarding him with better performance.
No. They're stealing the money.
Yeah, I'm very worried about the economic issues here. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's my next book, which I'm doing for Nation Books on this. But I write about it, as I say, on Truth Dig all the time in my column. And I'm very concerned that he's going to go trillions of dollars into debt on the banking stuff, that he's not willing to cut the military budget. And he might find himself in dire straits, even a year from now, you know, and then what are his options?
Yeah, I don't think he's got the right financial advisors, actually, do you?
Well, you know, there are two Obamas. There's the guy who worked on the south side of Chicago,
yes,
and dealt with ordinary people, and then there's the guy who got bamboozled at Harvard, and you know, with the best and the brightest, who created a lot of mischief in their day, and that's where Lawrence Summers, who was,
yep,
after all, at some point the president of Harvard before, after he was Secretary of Treasury. You know, I think sometimes people are too smart by half, and that, you know, and they, you know, there's a thing you never talk about in this country, and I don't know anything about Australia, so I can't speak about that. But somehow we stopped ever talking about class, class differences. We don't have this. It's really this. You just bring it up, and you're considered like old-fashioned, or lefty, or something. You know, and so we never raised the question of, you know, who's benefiting. Now Barack Obama does do that, and that's why they're attacking him now as a socialist. He at least talks about spreading it around a little bit. But we went through an insane period here in the last decades of people getting, some people getting incredibly wealthy, incredibly wealthy, and basically getting to write the laws in ways that would allow them to steal from the rest of us. And that was never challenged. If you tried to challenge it, whether you did it in academic circles or in journalistic circles or political circles, you were considered, you were marginalized instantly.
Yeah.
And yet that's the real issue now. Who are we saving this economy for? You know, what group? You know, here we devote very little resources to helping people stay in their homes. You know, if you even look at Barack Obama's plan, it's $75 billion. Well, gosh, he gave twice that, more than twice that, to one company, AIG, already, without asking anything in return. It's bizarre. You know, so I'm very worried that despite his good intentions and the good, you know, solid base of popular support he still has, that he may be going down the wrong road. I am concerned about
it. Yes. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but Robert Shear, you've given us a huge amount to think about. If people want to get involved in any of the issues we've talked about, I advise you to read Bob Shear's books, which are absolutely fascinating. Go to his website at truthdig.com, and you'll find some fascinating articles there, but more. Barack Obama got millions to participate in the democracy, built a huge grassroots movement. Don't let it drop. Just keep working flat out. I mean, our work has only just begun, and it's for both to save the society in the United States and all other countries, and actually to save life on the planet. And I am not exaggerating when I say that. So thank you very much, Robert Shear. It's been a fascinating program. And
I'll see you when you speak in Los Angeles.
I see you soon in Hollywood,
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye. My guest today was journalist Robert Shear, editor-in-chief of truthdig.com and author of 8 books, including his most recent, The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Shear can be heard on the political radio program Left, Right and Centre on KCRW, the National Public Radio affiliate in Santa Monica, California. If you are interested in the program today and other programs that we broadcast, please feel free to go to our webpage at ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and there is a page there by which you can donate money to help us proceed with this program, which I think is so very important. We would welcome your contributions and welcome your interest. And thanks for listening to If You Love This Planet today. We look forward to talking with you again next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.